Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, the number of murders in Chicago is down. For a city that's seen rising violence in recent years, it's a welcome turnaround. Many say street outreach workers are helping. We'll find out more. Also, we hear how federal funding freezes are impacting health research at some Illinois universities. We'll talk about some of the bills that failed to make it through the legislature in the recently concluded spring session. The Illinois State Bar Association has a program aimed at addressing legal deserts, especially in smaller and rural communities. And farmers are taking on more debt. What are the implications for the agriculture economy? Those stories and more coming up this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Starting us off this week, Chicago has seen its murder rate drop to the lowest point in a decade. Some credit publicly funded street outreach with reducing violence. Chip Mitchell went out to Chicago's West Side to find out more details.
I went to the Institute of Nonviolence Chicago and sat down with Fred Seaton. He supervises 9 street outreach workers in West Garfield Park, around where he grew up.
I'm 65 years old. I've been doing this work for 18 years.
He says that was after 18 years in prison. It's mid-morning, usually a quiet time, but suddenly Fred's getting a bunch of calls and texts.
What's going on?
There's been a shooting. Some of Fred's staffers are at the scene. There are 2 victims, a man and a woman.
They're trying to gather the information, see what it's about, find out family members. Everybody got a family member that's hot-headed, trying to find out who they really need to pay a lot of focus to.
Hot-headed?
Yeah, everybody got a crazy cousin.
And the crazy cousin might bring retribution.
He might.
Eventually, Fred gets notification about the shooting from the police. One of the victims has died, the man, 33 years old, gunshot wounds to the chest. Fred wants to check out the shooting scene and strategize with his staff on their response. He invites me to ride along. So I came to the West Side to hear about the street outreach that's helping drive down Chicago's murder numbers. But now I'll actually see how it works. We head to Fred's car, a 9-year-old gray sedan.
I have team on location. I have team at the hospital, team members at both locations.
They're all trying to find out whether the shooting was domestic violence or part of some other interpersonal conflict or something involving drug dealers or gangs, and not the big gangs that held sway in West Garfield Park when Fred was young. Today's gangs are much smaller, more like cliques.
That's it. Yes, Springfield and Mass.
We approach the shooting scene.
That got one of my staff there.
In yellow?
Yeah.
Fred's team members wear these neon T-shirts. He pulls up to one.
Hey, how y'all doing?
I see your Dolphins.
Okay, so describe what we're looking at here.
We're looking at a scene where the police has it taped off. They have blocked the street off. It's a crime scene.
I count at least 7 police vehicles.
Yes. So there go to all the white shirts. I guess they sitting there. The detectives, homicide.
The white shirts would be the bosses, police bosses.
Yes.
Then Fred gets a text from the police district commander.
Good morning, reaching out to get you any appreciation, any assistance that we can help.
That's what the commander says?
Yes.
Now, he's not expecting information from you, though.
No.
The commander seems to respect Fred. What his team is out to do.
This has been a long time coming, you know, to develop a professional understanding. The personal understanding is we don't share information. We don't work for you.
And that's key, because if Fred's staff shared information with the police, they'd lose the community's trust.
Our job is to do what we do, because we can get into some crannies and some holes that they can't get in. And to try to stop the shooting before the young men have to deal with law enforcement.
From the shooting scene, Fred heads to the hospital. That's where vital work takes place to prevent retaliation. 2 of his staffers are already there. The job includes listening and validating feelings.
I mean, when someone is experiencing trauma, they need some comfort. Want to show love to the families.
At the hospital, there's also crucial information to gather.
There might be somebody that's related, that's a friend, that you might have a relationship with, that can help you in determining your course of action.
Fred reaches the emergency entrance. There's a crowd outside, friends and relatives of the victim, dozens.
This is hostile.
Okay.
A hostile situation with a lot of people. The level of tension right now, trying to figure it out or point the fingers. What up, Mike?
Fred checks in with his staffers. The victim's loved ones still don't know he's deceased. When the word finally comes, they start crying, wailing. A man with a beard, he runs from the crowd to a car and climbs behind the wheel. Two women follow.
They just informed him that he did. The family trying to stop him from going retaliate against anybody.
The women get the man out of the car. All three embrace. They wail together. The man can't hold himself up. He collapses to the pavement.
Most important part about any crime scene or any shooting is buying time. That's very, 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 very important.
Just calm things down.
Yes. Get some level heads time to think. Who is this? What up?
Fred gets a call from a staffer back in the neighborhood.
All right, I'll slide on you in a minute.
He hangs up.
Interpersonal.
Interpersonal, like the conflict is not between street gangs.
That's a big relief.
Why?
Because when it's cliques involved, it's a longer mediation. This interpersonal, know the individuals, probably going to be arrest. It's a simpler strategy. Strategy now is try to get the family members not to react.
And who's going to do that?
The outreach staff from that community. So the strategy is going to be is to get to that young man.
The one at the hospital who tried to drive off.
Get to that young man, then get to two, three young men who's the young man's closest friend. And get to some of them young ladies that was around to stop this incident from escalating.
It's the approach that Fred's group has taken countless times. They cannot do much about the easy access to guns throughout the city, but in West Garfield Park, they can head off retaliation.
With relationship gathering and being credible messengers, we're going to be able to work with the community, try to stop the next shooting.
Fred heads from the hospital to his office, where he and his staff will get to work on the plan. I'm Chip Mitchell.
Illinois lawmakers filed more than 7,500 bills in the spring session. 615 of them crossed the finish line. Eric Stock reports on two high-profile bills that didn't get there.
First up, the Clean Slate Act stalled in the Illinois House, dimming the hopes of advocates who thought it might be called in the last hours of the spring session. It would have automatically sealed records for nonviolent criminal convictions, though police and prosecutors would still see those convictions. Toy Beasley is president of the McLean County Reentry Council, an organization dedicated to helping transition those who have been in prison. Beasley had a history of substance abuse and served prison time in the 1990s. That still affects him today, nearly 30 years later. His criminal record made it harder for him to find work. He also can't own a gun, and background checks make it difficult for him even to do volunteer work. That's why Beasley and his organization, the Reentry Council, have been trying to convince lawmakers that the Clean Slate Act would benefit more than just those whose records are sealed.
If a person come home from prison and they know that 3 years after their probation that they eligible to work in the medical field or work in an insurance industry and they can make, you know, $30, $40, $50 an hour, they 9 times out of 10 won't go back to prison.
Democratic State Representative Jehan Gordon Booth of Peoria sponsored the Clean Slate Act. She says it would have helped people transition back into society.
Get to the other side of their adjudication. They pay their fine, they pay their fee. We don't want them to continue to have to audition for their humanity. We don't want people to remain calcified in poverty. We want them to be able to take care of themselves, take care of their family, take care of their children, or whatever life that they want for themselves.
The Clean Slate Act had diverse support. Illinois State Police and the State's Attorneys Association joined criminal justice advocates and business groups to help get the bill through the Illinois House, where it passed by nearly 3-1 margin. But not everybody was a fan of the bill. Woodford County State's Attorney Eric Gibson says it would be unfair for an employer not to know if someone they hired had a history of, for example, stealing.
Somebody was convicted of an internal theft from their employer, and then they wait the requisite amount of years and don't have any issues, and then they go work for another employer, and doing a background check, they don't find that there was a theft from an employer, and then they end up hiring this person. The person does it again.
And Gibson says automatically sealing one's records is unnecessary, at least in Woodford County, since he says that process takes less than 3 months. Toy Beasley from the McLean County Reentry Council says critiques like these weren't the issue, but a tight deadline to pass the bill was. Representative Jahan Gordon Booth filed the bill in the last few days of the session, leaving little time for lawmakers to discuss. They spent the final hours of the spring session passing a budget. Gordon Booth says the bill was delayed because she took time to have conversations with Republican leaders and hear their concerns. And Toy Beasley with the Reentry Council isn't giving up hope. He says there will be another push to pass the bill during a special session or the veto session in the fall.
Basically, getting back out there on the boots on the ground, contacting senators again, especially the ones that we may think that were questionable. And then we're also going to be targeting Republican senators because we know we had some possibilities.
Another bill that failed to reach the finish line was the so-called Medical Aid in Dying Bill. It would have allowed patients with a terminal illness with 6 months or less to live to be prescribed a drug that would help them die. The bill drew outcries from religious and disability groups throughout the session. Critics called it assisted suicide, while advocates defended the bill for allowing patients to have more choice about their life. The bill was never called to the Senate after it passed in the House over the objections of Republican Representative Travis Weaver of Pekin.
When we passed that out of the House, I thought it was really a sad day in Illinois to know that we're talking out of both sides of our mouth. We're going to say we're against suicide, but we're also going to allow physician-assisted suicide. So that was really positive that did not end up passing out of the Senate.
Supporters of Medical Aid in Dying pointed out that a patient must undergo mental health evaluations with at least two doctors to show that they are of sound mind. Democratic Representative Sharon Chung of Bloomington was among the supporters. She says the process would provide patients with a terminal illness a decision that's rightfully theirs.
It's just being able to give somebody that choice at the end of their life to be able to die with dignity and to be able to make, again, it's a difficult choice, but I think just to be able to give somebody that option.
It's not clear when or if lawmakers will consider this proposal in the future. With reporting from WGLT State Capitol correspondent Cesar Toscano, I'm Eric Stock.
More than 600 workers will lose their jobs as Champaign-based Health Alliance plans to cease operations by the end of the year. The news comes after Carle Health recently announced Health Alliance will stop providing all types of coverage December 31st. The layoffs are set to begin July 8th and will continue through October of next year. Carle Health's president and CEO, Jim Leonard, has said Health Alliance faces a number of financial challenges, including inflation, rising prescription drug costs, higher volumes of chronic medical conditions, and increased demand for technology. A McLean County great-great-grandmother has found a way to help young cancer patients. Wilma Hoover has been auctioning made-from-scratch pies and offering pie-a-month subscriptions. She raised more than $6,000 at the spring St. Jude Feed and Auction in Hudson. That event supports St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. The soon-to-be 93-year-old told Michelle Steinbacher, for her, the cause is personal.
It basically goes to my grandson because he had a nephew of his wife's who was diagnosed with cancer. Unfortunately, he didn't make it. And that's where it all began for me. The whole family is very involved with it, you know. And like I said, I would love to be able to donate $1,000. But, you know, when you're a widow living on Social Security, you can't do that. But anyway, that's how I got involved in the auction. Started as a wild game feed. The hunters would bring their animals in, and they had this big dinner, and then they would have an auction. And then they started with they call it the St. Jude Feed and Auction. I think it's been about 9 years that they've been doing this. They had it at the bar, and then the bar got too small, and so now they rent a big tent. And they're renting a bigger tent for the next one.
So you've been doing this for several years. This year you raised $5,000 And if I understand correctly, you also raised an additional 1,500?
I do the two pies. So, and one was a French silk and the other was a fresh strawberry. And they went for 500 apiece. And then I did a birthday pie on the silent auction, and that was 120. And then the two certificates for pie of the month went for $5,000. Altogether, it was 6,120.
I believe you told me that this would be your 75th wedding anniversary, and you've been doing it since then. Your husband, Rod, passed away in 2001. What do you think Rod would make of the way this pie scenario has gone?
He'd be amazed. He would be absolutely amazed.
Wilma, how did you get into making pies?
I guess Rod liked pie, and I started making pie for him and his family, and little by little, it's just built up, you know. Of course, potlucks and that type of stuff, funeral dinners. You always got to have a pie for a funeral dinner. So.
What's your most popular pie? And when people request pies from you, what's your most popular pie?
Fresh strawberry in season is very popular. And now the French silk, that's really gone to sky high. And I had to learn that one because I had never made French silk.
Do you make pies seasonally? Do you make certain kinds at certain times of the year?
The spring, of course, that's your strawberry, your fresh strawberry. Summer, I make a fresh peach that's outstanding. That one I like. I like them all, but here again, you have to have the right peaches. Illinois and Georgia peaches are fine, but California peaches just don't make. There's something about California. I don't know what it is, but California don't have the right flavor. And then, of course, you come into autumn and you have your apple and your apple crumb. And then you get around to December, and it's lots of times berry pies at Christmas time.
I know you mentioned that you and your husband ran the grocery store in Hudson for many years, and you also worked at Bergner's, where you worked in the purse department in the handbag, so people might remember you from there. So what about these pies? Have you ever thought about making a business with that?
No. I think if it was a business, it wouldn't be as fun as it is, you know?
That's Wilma Hoover, a great-great-grandmother from McLean County. She bakes pies to raise money for St. Jude's. After speaking with Michelle Steinbacher, she treated the reporter to a piece of coconut cream pie in her kitchen. We've got more to come on Statewide. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A new book examines one of the key figures in Abraham Lincoln's rise to power. The book David Davis, Abraham Lincoln's Favorite Judge, is coming out from the University of Illinois Press. Davis was from Bloomington. One of the strong themes in the book is his impartiality. In this interview with Charlie Schlinker, the author Ray McCoskey tells how Davis managed to carry that impartiality through his work in the face of political relationships and a very partisan atmosphere in the nation at the time.
I think that he was able to do that because this was like part of his nature. He described himself as a man of fixed opinions. He shared with Lincoln a few similarities, but one was he relied on his own counsel. Neither he nor Lincoln really relied on other people's opinions. They considered them, but in the end, they relied on their own judgment. He was also a very strong-willed individual, and while criticism hurt him, it didn't detour him from his mission, which he thought was to act impartially, decide cases based on the facts, and leave his personal opinions aside, which he was extraordinarily able to do.
He wasn't a very good trial lawyer. He wasn't a noted legal scholar. But all of the evidence that you put forward in the book suggests that he was a really good judge. So what made him that in the absence of these other pieces of a skill set?
He was not a great trial lawyer. Right in the beginning of his career, he tried a couple cases in court, found out that was not his forte, and basically abandoned trial work. He wrote one U.S. Supreme Court opinion, the Milligan case, ex parte Milligan, which is a real solid constitutional case. But otherwise, you're right, he did not have any reputation for being a scholar or writing scholarly opinions. The people at the time would come to the courts It was a great celebration day when the court was in town, the traveling court, and people would come whether they had court business or not just to celebrate in the court days. And so people watched him try cases. They sat there and watched him when he was dealing with the lawyers and could tell firsthand or judge firsthand his impartiality. He also was very good at dealing with people. He was not a great public speaker, but he was good in dealing with people. And in addition to that, pushed mediation, settlement, arbitration, what would be called arbitration now, along with Lincoln. So his settlement skills, the ability of people to actually watch him, and his set nature to be an impartial and fair judge and not let personal interest interfere, all made him a popular judge, even though he wasn't a scholarly judge.
Since he was very close to Lincoln, you might think that Lincoln would do pretty well in front of Judge Davis. Was that the case?
He did well, but not any better than anybody else. As a matter of fact, in cases that we call bench trials, meaning the case was decided by the judge without a jury, Lincoln lost more cases, more bench trials in front of Davis than he won. Another indication of his impartiality. He was totally partial to Lincoln outside the courtroom. Inside the courtroom, Lincoln was treated just like any other lawyer.
You referenced the Ex parte Milligan case, which involved when military tribunals can and cannot be used to deal with civilian offenses and when the courts are open and when the regular courts are not open. He also had an opinion that might have presaged some of the civil rights cases of the 1960s, the Railroad Company versus Kate Brown. Why didn't that opinion last?
I wish I knew. It was sort of abandoned. It has some great points when you read about it. Kate Brown was an African-American getting on a train in Washington to take the 7-mile train trip to Alexandria, Virginia. No problem. Coming back, she is walking in to get in the board on the ladies' car. The conductor says, no, that's for whites only. You need to sit in the black people's car. She said, no. He said, you got to do it or I'm going to drag you off. She says, the only way you're going to get me off this train is to drag me off dead. She gets hurt pretty badly and is under doctor's care. The railroad company said, hey, all these cars are separate, yes, but they're equal. Our railroad charter from Congress says you can't discriminate in the use of cars on the basis of race. We're not doing that. In fact, the cars that are for whites going to Alexandria are the same cars that are reserved for blacks going back to Washington. But Davis rejected that, saying that the temper of Congress at the time they're talking about the 13th and 14th Amendments, the temper of Congress at the time is it would be a badge of slavery, a remnant of slavery, to separate the races. Now, that case was decided on the railroad's charter, not the 13th or 14th Amendments.
And along came Plessy versus Ferguson, which enshrined separate but equal, until some of the civil rights cases where you note that William O. Douglas used the same phrase, a badge of slavery. So was he hearkening back to that case? And why did Plessy get in the way?
I'm guessing he had read the case and maybe was harping back to the case. But you're exactly right. Douglas said exactly the same thing in Brown versus the Board of Education that Davis said in the railroad case so many decades ahead of time. The problem was that Plessy versus Ferguson intervened. And I'm guessing it is because the mood of the country changed. Segregation was now more acceptable to a larger number of people. I mean, the facts in Plessy versus Ferguson are almost identical to Kate Brown's case. Plessy, guy was getting on the train, got on the wrong car. They dragged him off of it. And I wish I knew exactly why the Davis opinion in Kate Brown case was just, as one scholar put it, just farmed off to a footnote in history. If that opinion would have been followed, there would have been no separate but equal doctrine because, as Davis said, it was a remnant of slavery. Just that idea was lost.
How does your book depart from other works about Judge Davis? What new light do you think it casts?
A few things. There is one other very good biography about Judge Davis, written by Willard King in 1960, a very good book. I tried to concentrate on two things. First, I spent two chapters talking about Davis's role in Lincoln's two senatorial campaigns for the U.S. Senate in 1855 and 1859. Willard King's book gives each of those campaigns one paragraph. I also demonstrate from those two campaigns what Davis learned, the lessons he learned from those campaigns that he would make work when he was masterminding Lincoln's presidential nomination. He learned that deals had to be cut. He also learned that he had to outwork the other side. In Davis's opinion, he lost the first election to the U.S. Senate because they got outsmarted, outworked by the Democrats, which they did.
We haven't given a name yet to these summative skills. Is that just the ability to organize?
Part of it is the ability to organize. Davis was an excellent organizer. Had been in his law practice, had been in his private life, personal life, had been as a judge. People always commented on that. Organization is one, but another thing he learned is you got to have a plan, you got to have a strategy.
How does the convention plan correspond to one of his failed Senate runs in which the winner in both ran from second place in the early rounds?
Lincoln said, it's not always best to have the most votes going into a contest. It's not necessarily the best to be the leading candidate. Sometimes it's best to be everybody's second choice and then work to make sure the leader fails, so now everybody's looking for their second choice. And this was their strategy, part of their strategy, not their full strategy, but part of the strategy at the Chicago Nominating Convention in 1860.
That's Ray McCoskey, a retired circuit judge and law school professor. His new book, Lincoln's Favorite Judge, is out this summer from the U of I Press. McCoskey spoke with Charlie Schlinker. A nonprofit supporting international students at Northern Illinois University is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. It comes during a stressful time for international students. Peter Medlin reports.
Johnson Warr says Network of Nations has been his home away from home since he landed in the U.S. from his home country of Ghana.
I realized that the distance from O'Hare Airport to NIU is over an hour. How do I get there from the airport?
Network of Nations picked him up and drove him to DeKalb for the first time, like they do for dozens of students every semester. A few years later, it's now Warr who picks up new international students from the airport, making sure they feel at home too.
It is an opportunity to extend the help that I was giving to new students coming.
Airport pickup is just one of their many services. They also provide English as a second language classes, religious groups, clothes, kitchen supplies, and much more. Executive Director Lisa Dietrich says it's grown from a small international student ministry to a network of over 20 local churches and a team of volunteers.
I think Network of Nations is all about hospitality and encouragement. It's all about bringing the world together in respect and honor.
She says they support around 300 students a year from over 120 countries. They're not part of the university, just a support organization for students. And for their first few decades, their meeting place was never near campus. But just last year, they moved into a new building only steps away from the student center.
Students come and make coffee and study and have a place to rest other than the library and going home for lunch.
As they've grown, services have expanded, but one of their most enduring events is Intercultural Cafe. It's a free weekly dinner with a rotating menu of dishes from around the world, often cooked by students, sharing a piece of their culture, of their home. Brandon Tai remembers his first cafe. He's a student from Cambodia.
I was kind of broke, so I was like, you know what, free food. Since the first day I was there, my first Friday, I think I struck up like friendships.
They come from very different countries and cultures, but he says they share the same longing for home, staying up late at night to call family, missing birthdays, weddings, and funerals.
The Network of Nations, it's like, it kind of helps them build their own like family here, and it makes like the longing and all of that a lot more bearable, or even maybe their life here even more enjoyable.
He says making friends from around the globe has changed his life in ways way beyond trying delicious new food.
It really opened my eyes to different people of different backgrounds and to learn like tolerance and like just having the ability to like sympathize with those who are much different from you.
Johnson Wuhr says that bond has felt more crucial as President Trump targets international students. Earlier this spring, the administration revoked, then reinstated the visas of 5 NIU students.
There is a wave of fear for all international students, and we are just hoping and praying that things will calm down so that they can have the peace of mind to study.
He says it's made some people scared to drive to the airport to pick up new students, that they'll get stopped by the police and they'll revoke their visa. Haniel George Mgodo is a recent grad from Tanzania, and he says he can't imagine an NIU experience without Network of Nations. In fact, he doesn't know how he would have gotten his diploma without them. When the pandemic hit, his parents back home lost their jobs. He couldn't pay school fees, and he was out of class for months as his dreams of graduation evaporated.
I was actually forced to go back home on January 2021, but through Network of Nations, specifically Lisa, she introduced me to a group of families that were from a Lutheran church and that they agreed to sponsor my education.
And like many alums, he stays involved with the group.
It was amazing in that it made being away from home feel like home.
When you're so far from home, it's tough for family to travel across the world to watch you walk across the stage to receive your diploma. That's why, on top of their services, Dietrich says her and her volunteers go to graduation every year to cheer them on. And she hopes they can keep growing this home away from home for the next 25 years. I'm Peter Medlin.
Researchers at universities have been left in limbo by federal funding freezes ordered by the Trump administration. That includes those who spent decades digging into critical public health problems. The Chicago Sun-Times health reporter, Elvia Malagon, talked with researchers at Northwestern University and the University of Illinois Chicago, and she told Melba Laura what she learned.
So let's start by talking about the scope of the Trump administration's crackdown on federal spending for research. Tell us a little bit about that.
The Trump administration has already made massive cuts to science-related agencies, including the National Institutes of Health, known as NIH. And this is the agency that really provides grants to science researchers to conduct all of these projects. And already they've ended 694 grants, which total $1.8 billion.
And there are impacts everywhere, but you looked at the impact at Northwestern University and the University of Illinois Chicago. Why did you pick those two schools?
We wanted to pick a public institution and then a private institution to see really how this is playing out. And Northwestern, of course, has an endowment that's worth $14 billion, whereas UIC really has a fraction of that. And already the Trump administration has been targeting Northwestern and said it would freeze $790 million in research funds, which is equivalent to how much they receive for about a year.
And in your reporting, you highlighted a UIC researcher doing some diabetes-related research who may have to end that work that he's doing this summer. Can you tell us about him?
Professor Timothy Koh has been researching the science behind diabetic wounds. For him, this research is really important because diabetic wounds, if they're not healed properly, could lead to amputations. And once a person has an amputation, the death rate is really alarming. And he's been doing this work since 2011, and he had been receiving federal funds through NIH to do this kind of research. But he hasn't been told what's going to happen to his grant. So his assumption is that it's going to run out by the end of this summer.
And when you talk to him, did he say he thinks there's a way that he can get private money or corporate or foundation money that can replace all the federal money that's been lost?
He said it's unlikely that he'll get any of those funds to continue his research, especially because for him, he's really digging into the science behind all of this. His work isn't tied to a device or a medicine that folks and corporations could see as profitable. And for him, a place like the NIH that was giving away these grants, it was really to develop new ideas that could help inform the science behind this. So eventually it'll lead to a payoff, but it won't be an immediate payoff.
We know that people outside labs can be affected by cuts to medical research, too. What did you learn about that in your reporting?
In the Lower West Side, I spoke to the Working Family Solidarity, who has been working with UIC on a project looking at the health outcomes for people who do jobs such as working as a street vendor or a day laborer. And then at Northwestern, they've been running this long-term study called RADAR, which has been looking at HIV. And they, as part of the study, they administer thousands of HIV tests each year. And participants have been telling them that that's how they learned that they were living with HIV, and that's how they were connected to healthcare.
Elvia, thanks for talking to us about federal funding cuts for research at some of our local universities.
Thank you so much, Melba.
That's Sun-Times Health reporter Elvia Malagon.
Governor Pritzker goes back to college. We'll have that story for you just ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. With a mix of dad jokes, earnest advice, and jabs at the Trump administration, Governor J.B. Pritzker recently addressed Knox College graduates. Jane Carlson was there and has this story.
Well, good morning, Knox College.
Pritzker told graduates that as a dad, he loves giving commencement speeches because it gives him the chance to do what dads love to do the most, dispense advice to a completely captive audience.
So first piece of advice. You don't need to subscribe to every single streaming service. You don't. Frankly, if you have Netflix and Apple Plus and whatever HBO is calling itself now, you are mostly covered. If you want to mix in a little Hulu or Disney Plus, I'm not going to fight you on that.
He also told them to turn off the lights when they leave a room and to put air in their tires.
I know that when that little tire gauge comes on your dashboard, you view it in the same way that Elon Musk views the United States Constitution, as a mere suggestion.
But Pritzker says because graduates are entering a world he calls vastly crazier than any time anyone can remember, he probably needed to dig a bit deeper in his advice. He says the most critical thing he's learned in 60 years on Earth and six as governor is to show up, to be generous with your time. He says he wants graduates to have confidence, but also to have doubt.
Doubt prompts us to ask good questions. Questions like, am I looking at all the facts or just the ones I want to see? Should I rely solely on nervous first impressions or should I give a second date a chance? Should I trust everything that my uncle posts on Facebook? Is it a good idea to accept a jumbo jet from a foreign country that would very much like to spy on us?
While on campus, Pritzker posed next to the plaque on Old Main that commemorates the site where Abraham Lincoln debated Stephen Douglas in 1858. The governor says he had a few invitations to deliver commencement addresses this year, but he says he wanted to come to Knox College because of its abolitionist roots.
Ignore the coastal institutions who love to brag about their pedigree and history. You will hold a diploma from a college that outshines them in a heritage that is exceedingly rare, a community built around the concept that our lives should be lived every day with courage.
Pritzker was awarded an honorary degree from Knox at the commencement ceremony. So were Chicago artist Theaster Gates and alumna and benefactor Mary Kent Knight. Journalism major Parise Imtiaz was selected by her peers to deliver the student address. Imtiaz says she came to the U.S. from Pakistan with two suitcases and 1,000 questions.
I left behind family, familiarity, and the comfort of being understood without an explanation. I arrived in Galesburg to cornfields, stretched for miles, and a silence that felt nothing like home. But I stayed. I stayed when I missed home so badly it ached. I stayed when I felt like an outsider in classrooms where nobody looked or sounded like me. I stayed because somewhere deep down, I knew I wasn't just chasing a degree, I was fighting for a voice.
Imtiaz says she and her fellow graduates are entering a world that's complicated. Politically and socially, there's division, chaos, and noise. But she says they can meet that with clarity, conviction, and care, and use their voices, even when it's uncomfortable. I'm Jane Carlson.
Illinois teachers are getting new guidelines on how to use artificial intelligence in the classroom. Teaching organizations with the nonprofit advocacy organization Teach Plus developed a bill that state lawmakers have approved. Sarah Merman is a math teacher and one of the fellows. She says the group took input from 200 educators across the state.
It was very clear teachers needed more guidance and they needed more training on AI. It's something that's in our classrooms every day. And to be frank, teachers don't feel comfortable using it.
The proposal directs the State Board of Education to develop new guidance by next summer on how schools can use AI while avoiding bias and navigating privacy concerns with student data. It still needs the governor's signature. The Illinois State Bar Association has announced the newest round of fellows for their Rural Practice Fellowship Program. It's part of an effort to take on what they say is a lawyer shortage in the state and incentivize lawyers and law students to practice where there's a need. Looking at the numbers, you'll find Illinois counties with five or less lawyers, even some with just two or three. The American Bar Association says those are legal deserts. They define that as areas with less than one attorney per 1,000 residents. Brian Sapp has more details on the program.
Angel Worzenick is a lawyer in Mattoon, and she oversees the fellowship program for the ISBA.
I went to high school in Oak Park, which is a suburb of Chicago. I went to U of I, loved Central Illinois, and wanted to stay. And so I got a job in Mattoon out of law school with no reason to be in Mattoon other than that was a job. I'd never heard of Mattoon before. I am the story that this program is seeking to replicate, basically, without the stipend. You know, one of the reasons I think that I end up being super actively involved is, A, I love being down here, but B, I can speak to the, you know, the transition from a more urban upbringing to a more rural life now. I mean, because that is literally my actual story.
What is the challenge kind of overall with legal representation, the idea behind legal deserts? What are we looking at around the state?
I mean, the issue is there's not enough attorneys to represent all of the people that need legal representation. And so that means either they are leaving the issue unaddressed and just hope for the best, or they are representing themselves and also, I guess, hoping for the best. And that makes the practice and running a courthouse a lot more complicated. The other angle is, why is there a shortage of attorneys? And to that, I have lots of ideas and no real answer. The simple answer is that new/younger attorneys just are not coming to the more rural areas. Unfortunately, for every person that you talk to who didn't make that move, the answer is a little bit different. It's not all one reason. Well, there's some people for whom they would not be happy because they want all of the amenities that living in a city would provide for the rest of their, you know, for their non-work lives. For some people, they're worried about where their spouse would work. For some people, they're worried about how they'll find a spouse. And for some people, it's just that they are concerned about making less money.
The thing that caught my interest was this fellow program. What is that and how does it work?
So the Rural Practice Fellowship Program is a two-pronged program. There's an associate's program and a law clerk program. And the law clerk program is basically you clerk for a summer for 8 weeks for a law firm, and there's a $5,000 stipend that goes with it. For the associate program, it's a one-year commitment, but there's a $10,000 stipend that goes with it. Both programs have various requirements in terms of pro bono services, free legal aid type services, and attending the programming that we provide, which if you're a licensed attorney would give you the continuing legal education credit. Our notion was that regardless of what your individual concern was about relocating to a rural area, money solves most problems. Our other notion is if you place people in these small towns across the state and you give them a chance to be a part of that community and see what life is like there, then some large percentage will say, huh, I like it here, and stick around. And at the very least, for the associates anyways, you get a year of an attorney being in the area, you know, helping with the legal need. And so it's sort of, there's no downside, and there's the potential for a pretty big upside.
Yes, I'm from Anna, born and raised here. Went away for undergraduate for a little while, came back and went to law school at SIU, and now I'm back here.
Ellie Basler was a fellow in 2023 and began working with Elvis Cameron at the Cameron Law Firm in Anna.
I always knew that I wanted to be an attorney, but whenever this opportunity here to work with Elvis here at Cameron Law Firm came up, that was something that I really saw myself fitting into, to be able to give back to the community that I grew up in. And as I mentioned earlier, things like estate planning really are a public service that everyone should have access to. So being able to interact with people in the community that I've grown up around and help them with that kind of stuff has been super rewarding for me.
What do people have to do if they don't have, you know, good representation?
For us, in the estate planning field, you know, folks just go without doing any estate planning, or they rely on handshake deals that aren't necessarily legal. But that is an issue that you run into when there aren't many attorneys around here, is that folks either because of physical restrictions or financial restrictions, just don't engage with an attorney for things. And that can cause major problems down the road for their families.
You can find a list of this year's fellows on the ISBA's website. They also have maps and data with the ratios of legal representation for the counties where you live. I'm Brian Sapp.
Farmers have been taking on more debt lately following years of really low levels of borrowing. At the end of last year, the volume of farm loans not related to real estate was up 25% compared to a year earlier. The trend continued in the first quarter of this year. Is the increased use of debt a sign of a financial downturn in the ag sector? Will Bauer explores the question.
To understand the current ag economy, let's start with what got us here. Why are farmers using more loans than they have been? Tate Berg is an economist with the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. He also farms himself.
When the ag economy is doing really well and farm income is up, farm loan demand goes down. And as the farm economy struggles, the farm loan demand goes up. So we're kind of seeing a little bit of both.
And he's watching those numbers closely. The Minneapolis Fed just put out a report showing loan demand is up. Berg says farm income is down for a few reasons. The main one is commodity prices have dropped quite a bit over the last 3 years. For example, soybeans sold at just shy of $18 per bushel when they peaked in 2022. Now it's less than $11. And Berg says that's coupled with high input costs.
It makes it really tough, so there's a squeeze on both sides of the equation.
Fertilizer and ag equipment are some of the things that have been pricey, and that's led to greater need for loans, according to Nate Kaufman. He's an economist with the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City.
The concern would be if this type of environment, meaning reduced profit margins, persists for some amount of time, a year, 2 years, 3 years, you could envision some scenarios where it does lead to more financial stress.
For some farmers, these trends are already creating stress.
This should process out. There's 32 turkeys here, and it should process out to like between 350 to 400 pounds of ground turkey.
Anna Morell is showing me her farm. She also raises chickens for meat. She has ducks, geese, and chickens for eggs and grows tons of produce.
And they make the funniest sounds.
All to be sold at farmers markets in central Illinois. Morell also serves as the president of the Central Illinois Young Farmers Coalition. While standing inside a new barn, she says these conditions are extra tough, especially on young farmers.
There's not a ton of money to go around for farmers right now. And right now with federal freeze and tariffs, I'm not quite sure how we're all going to fare, but...
Morell says she feels fortunate that she and her husband don't have a loan for anything on the farm right now, but they do have plans to expand, and that could require financing. Tariffs also might mean higher prices on things like feed. Morell says she's been able to avoid raising prices on her eggs for several years. With tariffs, that might have to change.
But then also we want to balance being able to serve our community, serve people who may not be able to afford our higher prices. And even if personally not financing anything right now, tariffs are definitely going to be a concern.
However, there are some that believe more loans aren't necessarily a sign of a weakening ag economy. Roger McOwen is a professor of agricultural law and taxation at Washburn University School of Law in Kansas.
Yeah, the debt levels look high, but your underlying asset values are also high. Those have not deteriorated, which means you still have the ability to pay your debt.
Land values, for instance, remain high. So a common benchmark economists consider the debt-to-asset ratio is in good shape. That's also true for what's called the current ratio, or a farmer's ability to pay their debt, McCohen says. And that tells him farmers are seeking loans with an eye to the future.
They're not necessarily incurring more debt because they're behind on things. And the current ratios tell me that. The debt-to-asset ratios tell me that. They're not borrowing because they're in trouble. They're borrowing because they're anticipating greater investment slash sales later on.
While farmers keep a close eye on tariffs and their bottom lines, ag economists will be watching whether farmers keep making their loan payments on time. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Will Bauer.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being here, and be with us again next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.